From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's show, the task of repairing and rebuilding New Orleans. We talk with city planner Christina Ford. From 1992 to 2000, she was director of city planning for the city of New Orleans. She's currently a professor at Bowdoin College in Maine. Also, we talk with comic actor Eugene Levy. He was one of the original cast members of SCTV, a sketch comedy show which also starred Rick Moranis, Catherine O'Hara, and the late John Candy. Levy had memorable film roles like Best in Show and the American Pie films. Now he stars in The Man. And music critic Ken Tucker reviews two new country music CDs, Time Well Wasted by Brad Paisley and Hillbilly Deluxe by Brooks and Dunn. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. As rescue operations continue in New Orleans and other areas affected by Hurricane Katrina, the Army Corps of Engineers reports it has repaired breaches in two levees that protected the city from floodwaters. The Corps has begun pumping water out of the city, but it's expected to take many weeks before it's dry. Soon officials will turn to the task of rebuilding. To discuss the future of New Orleans, I spoke this morning with Christina Ford. From 1992 to 2000, she was director of city planning for the city of New Orleans. She's currently a professor of environmental studies at Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine. Tell us what happens to buildings and homes that have stood in, let's say, 2 to 10 feet of water for a period of weeks or months. Give us an idea of which of these structures can be saved. Let's start with wooden frame houses.
Well, I think that the wooden frame houses will all probably have to be torn down. I mean, unless they have been built on piers that are stone. And the architecture in New Orleans has some, aside from the beauty that everyone in America probably is aware of or at least has seen pictures of, they also have a function. The raised cottages, one of their functions has been to keep the level of the first floor up above floods. And some of my friends, for instance, live in very, very high raised cottages. They're 12 or 15 feet above the level of the street. So houses that are like that and that have got stones as their foundation will probably survive. The ones, and there are some houses, I knew of one in the French Quarter where I used to live, that was built right on the ground. And that house probably, I can't imagine that it could survive.
Now, what about bigger structures, office buildings, shopping centers?
Well, I think that the office buildings, if you can see them, I've watched the helicopters go over the city, and the many of those office buildings are relatively new, and they were built when the building codes took into account flooding and hurricane and so forth. And so I think that there may be horrible, unimaginable water damage in the first floor, the first two floors of some of those buildings. But I think that the buildings are structurally sound.
And can be re-inhabited, you think, with some work?
Yes, I believe so. I'm a city planner, which I think one of the things you have to be a city planner is an optimist. And so I am optimistic that a lot of the buildings, once we clear away all the debris and the horrible things that are left in that water, that what we'll find is that those buildings downtown will be all right. You asked me earlier, Dave, about shopping centers. My sense of many shopping centers there is that they're built on a slab. And I would think that the damage to those structures would be horrible. I can tell you also, I had a friend who lived in a building in the Faubourg Marigny, which is just downstream of the French Quarter, who lived in an old house that was about a block away from the levee. And the building was stone. And he showed me once that there you could see the water line in his house from when Hurricane Betsy came through. And it was, I would say it was 12 feet high. And that building stood. I mean, it was a fine building. And he had left that old stain from the water just as a historical memory.
So there's hope for some of these places, yeah.
Oh, I think so. And I think one of the things that will happen once all the horrible part is over, that the city will start to really assess what they have and what can be salvaged and what needs to be rebuilt and in an orderly way bring the city back.
Planning is, by its nature, deliberative, the notion being that we make good decisions when we really think about it, when we hear from all of the interested parties and have a good airing of the issues. I mean, there will be enormous pressure with, as you say, hundreds of thousands of people, beyond those, of course, in big places like the Astrodome, but just folks who have been evacuated from their homes. What will that pressure do to the deliberative process?
Well, I think in my opinion, there has to be a very strong centralizing authority that makes sure that nothing is done in haste, because in all of this, I think that there are parts of the city that one might think as a planner, oh, if only we could start over. We wouldn't have the poorest people in town living so vulnerably, so far below sea level. And yet at the time, and I was director of city planning for 8 years in New Orleans, at the time it was unimaginable to say what we should do, say, to the lower Ninth Ward, is to move the people who live there into some other facility, maybe a barracks, something, and then move their houses onto safe ground, and then go back in and fill that land so that it comes up as high as, say, the French Quarter is, and then move the houses back, and then move the people back. It's unimaginable how much money that would have cost, and no one, I think, would have thought there was a good idea to spend the money that way. They probably thought it was better to spend it on education, which is a rational choice, it seems to me. So my point to all of that is that in all of this, nature has wiped the slate clean in some areas, and we shouldn't be in a hurry to rebuild something the way that it was. What we should do is to figure out how we can rebuild it so that we don't have people again so poor and so vulnerable.
I've got to ask the question that Dennis Hastert, the Speaker of the House, asked and then drew a lot of criticism for. I mean, this is a city, established in 1718 and has been sinking ever since or losing some elevation, and much of it is below sea level. Some will ask the question, does it make sense to rebuild a city on that site where it is so vulnerable to this kind of catastrophe?
As a professor of land use planning, I try to take what the speaker said in stride. I thought it was a bad time for him to have said such a thing. It seemed mean-spirited when there are so many people out of the city who are homeless. But what he's talking about, I think one can deal with rationally. There has been a great deal of work in the past that, and these are by people who are engineers and who know something about geography, that the Mississippi River seems to want to join the Atchafalaya River, which is to the west of New Orleans, and that the rivers kind of seem to want to join together, and there has been talk in the past that we should go ahead and let it, and that would be a straighter route to the Gulf of Mexico. Well, we let it, and we let it go down straight to the Gulf of Mexico, which may make some rational sense, and what? There isn't a city there, and so we'd have to spend several billion dollars to build a new city there where we have a new outlet to the port or to the Gulf, or we can say spend the same amount of money because there is plenty that will be salvageable in New Orleans and keep it the way that it was. And so the choice that he offers, not rebuild New Orleans, he's creating a false choice in my mind.
Just to one more thought on this subject. I read that one expert, a professor from Texas A&M, said that some are going to say, if you want to rebuild New Orleans in such a vulnerable place, if citizens really want to do that, they should do it on their own tab and not with federal tax dollars. I mean, don't spend my money to once again leave yourselves vulnerable to this kind of catastrophe. Do you expect that kind of debate to be a factor?
The question that I think many people have is whether or not it makes sense to rebuild New Orleans or to build something that is so vulnerable to hurricanes. And I think that when one looks at the economic importance of the Port of New Orleans, it derives mostly from the fact that it's at the foot of the Mississippi River and that it drains out this whole central part of the country. What moves through that port is a huge part of our national economy. So the issue is, do we rebuild New Orleans, or do we maybe make another port on the Gulf of Mexico that is maybe you have the Mississippi River rejoin the Atchafalaya? However, no matter what we do, where the river goes is to a place that is by definition vulnerable. The Gulf of Mexico is where many hurricanes go. And so I think that's an interesting way to think about this. And Dave, what I really think is when people ask questions like that, it is that their mind needs a break from how big this problem is. I don't think that we can build any port at the foot of the Mississippi River or the Atchafalaya that isn't vulnerable at some point with some degree of probability to another hurricane. We can do better, and we can make sure we don't have such human suffering in the next time around. But I think that the odds are that no matter where we build a port on the Gulf of Mexico, and that we have to, that this is a risk.
Let's talk about some of the practical issues when you're talking about residential communities of poor and working people. And I want to just briefly evoke an experience that Philadelphia had 20 years ago, where there was a police confrontation with an armed radical group, which was mishandled. You may know of this. A lot of the audience won't recall, though, that what happened was that there was a fire developed as a part of the police confrontation, which raged out of control and destroyed a block and a half of row homes. 60 families were homeless overnight, and there was an enormous desire, naturally, to make these people whole who were put out of their houses through no fault of their own. And the interesting question that arises in such a situation, which I think, and a similar one will arise in New Orleans, is one way to do that is to simply compensate people and let them relocate where they can or rebuild their lives where they can. But people also then will say, wait, this isn't just houses. This was a community. I have kinfolk here. I have neighbors. I want that community back. And I could imagine that in many, many communities in New Orleans, people will say, I don't want a check. I want my house back where it stood with my neighbors where they stood. As a planner, how do you deal with that issue?
Well, Dave, I think you're exactly right about how people feel in New Orleans. I was watching on the news today that there are people who won't leave yet. They say that they want to stay in their house. New Orleans is a town, it's often said, of families. It can seem like everybody is related to everybody else in that town. And I think that their desire will be to stay together. I think they need to feel like there is something left in their life. Imagine what their houses are like. The possessions they had, which are priceless to them, old pictures and so forth, it's all gone. And I just think in human terms, that it's important that if people want to stay together, that we figure out a way to let them stay together. I think that maybe we don't have to do anything so draconian as to say we're going to get everybody a check and then they can go find their way in Texas or Missouri or wherever. That instead what we do is give people some options and then let them choose. But my sense is that, you know, New Orleans wasn't a stage set. New Orleans was a city in which people lived, and a lot of what's so appealing about it was precisely the people who lived there, and they should be able to stay together. I was reading something in the Times yesterday by Mark Childress, who's a writer who wrote a thing about the 22 things that he would miss about New Orleans, and one of them, for me, was a sort of source of hope. He said it's the only city in America where you can count on, within the first 15 minutes of your arrival, somebody will either call you baby or darling. Well, that wasn't the script for somebody who lived in New Orleans. That was the culture. And I'm sure if you went into the Astrodome now, they'd call you baby. And my point there is that that culture, if the people want to recreate it, then this country should allow them to.
My guest is Christina Ford. She was for 8 years the chief city planner for New Orleans. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Christina Ford. She was for 8 years the chief city planner for the city of New Orleans. Right. Well, clearly, saving lives and then addressing the rebuilding tasks are urgent. But I want to take advantage of our access to you and all of your experience as a New Orleans centric planner to look back for just a moment in the 8 years that you were there. One of the things that I know that you do as a city planner is you develop a capital budget, and there are competing demands upon limited dollars for tourist infrastructure, for neighborhood redevelopment, and I'm sure in New Orleans for the system of levees and canals which protected the city. I mean, as you were participating in or at least witness to discussion of the levee system and whether it could or should withstand a Category 4 or 5 hurricane, I'm wondering, what was your sense of how vulnerable the city was?
Well, my sense was that the city was very vulnerable. The city, I mean, that's something that you know probably the first week you decide to live in New Orleans. Someone tells you, someday the hurricane is going to come that moves up the Mississippi River at the exact time that is high tide and that the city will be flooded. I will tell you, you, however, have touched on something else, which is why I think there needs to be the Central Redevelopment Authority. And that is, the city of New Orleans didn't have many discussions about the levee system because that's a different jurisdiction. It's the levee district, which is, you know, statewide. It's, in fact, it goes through several states. There's the Orleans Parish Levee District. There is the Port of New Orleans, which is a state agency. And coordinating all of them was always difficult. The voters of New Orleans weren't asked to pass a bond issue for to restore the levees. I did hear former Mayor Bartholomew the other day who said that at the time they made the choice of how to build the levee system, they said, okay, what we're going to do is build a levee system that can withstand a Category 3 hurricane. And the person interviewing him said, well, why would you do that? Why didn't you say Category 5? And he said, well, I wasn't in those discussions, but I rather imagined that the cost difference between being prepared for a Category 3 and a Category 5 was so huge that taxpayers would have been unwilling to pay for it. Well, with the benefit of hindsight, we see that we'll pay many multiples of what it would have cost to have prepared for a Category 5, and we may make a better decision in the future. But that's why I say, Dave.
Well, if I get your point, what you're saying is that because of the kind of the jurisdictional lines and the bureaucratic funding streams, the taxpayers were never really asked whether they wanted to do that.
Well, the local ones weren't. Right. That's right. And I think that's a national decision to decide how much money to spend on levies. And I think that's why all these factors now, we have a chance to look at them again and make some better decisions in the future.
You know, in this moment of crisis, we're all pulling together and we stand as one. But once people are saved from immediate harm and a reconstruction process gets underway, various powerful economic interests will want to assert themselves. And you, of course, coped with this as a city planner for many years. I'm interested in things like, for example, the tourism and hospitality interests. I wonder, what role will they play, and will their ideas for reconstruction and using what will inevitably be somewhat limited dollars, will their ideas be different from those, for example, who want to preserve the neighborhoods of the working poor?
Well, I think, Dave, that's an interesting question, and I think it's why we need some of the best minds in America to come deal with it. You know, we could rebuild the French Quarter. We could rebuild the Garden District, which are two of the favorite tourist destinations. And there will be a great urgency felt by people in the tourism industry to put that back on its feet. I mean, that will be secondary to the Port of New Orleans, but then that'll be right up there. However, I have heard people say, what we don't want when we rebuild New Orleans is for it to look ersatz, that it looks like this is Disneyland's version of what used to be New Orleans. And in that statement, which I understand, in that statement is contained the real beauty of New Orleans. When you went to the French Quarter, it wasn't that each and every building that you saw was beautiful or beautifully maintained. There were plenty of poor people who lived in the French Quarter or in the surrounding, in the Faubourg Marigny or in Treme. And I think that the flavor that people feel like they are enjoying, not feel like they were enjoying, that they enjoyed when they came to New Orleans was partly, we are diverse, and right next door to rich people live very poor people. And it's that flavor of the city which, to my mind, we must recreate, or else it won't be a very interesting tourist destination anymore. It will be like going to Disneyland. So I think that there is a way that that can be expressed by economists that will make sense to somebody who's deciding how to rebuild the city and not just simply clean it up.
I'm wondering how you felt about the hedonistic New Orleans, the girls gone wild kind of part of the city's image.
Well, I should tell you, Dave, that we lived on Bourbon Street for 11 years.
And on so, Bourbon Street?
Yes, way down Bourbon Street. So we were two blocks from the closest bar. So it isn't the wild part of Bourbon Street, but Bourbon Street nonetheless. And the hedonism, you kind of watch it, and sometimes you'd leave for the sake of Mardi Gras and then come back, and other times just enjoy it. It's a city of license. It's a city that lets what you think of yourself, all of your illusions, be true. And that's, I think that's one of its charms. And so I may not like something that someone does, or all I think is, I wouldn't do that. I don't think you shouldn't do that. And I do think, realistically speaking, that part of the tolerance the New Orleanians have is that they know how provisional their life is. It's completely provisional, reliant on the levee system and on a hurricane not hitting them, and that that sense of how provisional they are, first of all, allows them to really seize moments and to enjoy life while they have it, on the theory that it may not last long. And I think probably the thing I admire most about New Orleanians is their tolerance for other people, a sort of live and let live attitude.
Well, Christina Ford, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Of course, I enjoyed it.
Christina Ford. From 1992 to 2000, she was director of city planning for the city of New Orleans. She's now professor of environmental studies at Bowdoin College in Maine. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Basement Street is a street where all them characters from the first precinct meet. In New Orleans, city of a million dreams, and you never know how nice it seems when you're way down south in New Orleans and you be hugging and a kissing. That's what I've been missing. Hear all that good music, Lord, if you just listen. Yeah, New Orleans is true. And that's why I got these Basin Street blues.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor Audio Courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Eugene Levy. His films include Splash, Best in Show, A Mighty Wind, and the American Pie films. He now stars in the new movie, The Man. And Ken Tucker reviews two new takes on the country music mainstay, The Drinking Song. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest actor Eugene Levy has appeared in more than 60 films. In the late 70s and early 80s, he was a cast member of SCTV, along with Rick Moranis, Catherine O'Hara, and John Candy. Since then, he's had memorable roles in films including Best in Show, A Mighty Wind, Waiting for Guffman, and the American Pie films. Levy has usually played supporting roles, but now he's starring with Samuel L. Jackson in the new film, The Man. Levy plays Andy Fiddler, a dental supply salesman in Detroit for a convention, who stumbles into a drug investigation led by Derek Van, a tough, cynical detective played by Jackson. In this scene, the detective grills Levy's character about a drug suspect he's just encountered.
So what's this guy look like?
Well, he had very good teeth.
What does he look like?
He looks good. He looks good. He had a very nice face, very handsome face. He was a very attractive man. No, not to me. I am married to a woman. And even if I wasn't married, I don't mean that kind of attractive. Personally, he was not attractive to me.
Describe him to me.
Short hair. Short hair. Which made his head look smaller than it actually is. And I only mention that because I've been told my head is somewhat large. And when I looked over at his, it's like, you know, when you look through binoculars the wrong way, it looks...
That's you. Answer it!
Well, Eugene Levy, welcome to Fresh Air.
My pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Good to have you. You're starring in this new film with Samuel Jackson,
the man. Yes,
yeah. You've made a career of, and sometimes stealing the show with relatively smaller roles. I mean, putting on a great character here. You star with Samuel Jackson, but you're the one that really carries it. I mean, you.
Wow,
he's your straight man.
He is my straight man. He's a damn good straight man too. The only difference is, you know, that the straight man used to slap the funny guy.
Right.
Yeah, I get to slap the straight man in this thing. So, you know, I don't know if you call it a step up, but it's a bigger role, more of a challenge, and I loved it.
And you actually get chased and shot in the rear end at one point. You are in a. You get thrown onto the hood of a car, and you did some of these stunts yourself. Is that right? Spry young fellow like
yes,
you.
Yes, I did. I'm such a professional. Running. I did a lot of this stuff. This is not something I would maybe want to do again real soon. Physical comedy is not my forte, I don't think. But I did do running. I did do falling. I got shot in the rear. I was got hit by a car. I mean, you know, kind of not hit by a car, but close, jumping up on the hood. I get tossed out of a car. There's a lot of stuff in here that I think will last me for the rest of my life.
If you're just joining me, my guest is actor Eugene Levy. He's done more than 60 films. His most recent, in which he stars with Samuel L. Jackson, is The Man. Well, let's talk about SCDV a little bit. We have a few clips of some characters of yours, and I thought we would start with you as Stan Schmenge, who, with John Candy playing his brother Yash Schmenge, were the Schmenge brothers who hosted the Happy Wanderer Polka Show. And,
that's right.
And in this clip, you as Stan Schmenge are doing something which you often do in the show, which is to speak with some of the old folks who come to dance the polka and enjoy some of some cabbage rolls and coffee supplied by your good friend, Mrs. Yachke. Let's listen.
Mrs. Yachke really outdid herself tonight with her delicious homemade cabbage rolls and coffee. Can't be beat. Are you folks having a good time? I just asked him a question, but he couldn't answer because his mouth was full with Mrs. Yachke's cabbage rolls. Oh, well, that's live television for you.
Maybe he should wash it down with some coffee.
Oh, well.
How about that?
Brings a smile to you still, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. I honestly had the greatest time doing. I think the most fun I had on the show was working with John in some of those situations.
Tell us a little bit about where the Schmenge brothers came from.
Well, you know, we were doing our show in Edmonton at that time, and there wasn't a lot to do in Edmonton when you weren't working. So on our off days, I mean, if Sunday was our off day, we would just go up to, you know, somebody's. We were staying in a hotel. And we would visit. So I would go up to John's room, and we were sitting around one day watching television. And there were a couple of we switched we on the remote control, and we're in the and we come on this upon this polka show. And there's a couple of guys up there, and Schmenge was a word that we would kind of toss around on the show, kind of like, well, there's a couple of Schmenges. It was just one of those words, and we kind of wrote these guys, and it's not it's a little Lawrence Welk in a way, but the idea that you have two guys, lovely guys, sweet guys, good guys. They know their stuff. They know their polka stuff. But, you know, how in the world they have their own show is just beyond comprehension.
Well, one way is that they have their own travel agency, the Schmenge Brothers Travel Agency, and they do commercials, and those are fun too.
This is true. Yeah, they were very shrewd businessmen.
And Lithuanian, was that the idea? Or was it some general East
Well, Lutonia. Lutonia.
Is that what it was? Lutonia.
Yes, was where they were from, right. And it was located somewhere on the dark side of the Balkans.
Well, let's hear another character of yours. And this is Bobby Bittman, who is a hack comedian, let's say.
Well, let's say he's a Vegas comic. Hack comedian would be complimentary, you know, in the kind of 60s Vegas style of, say, you know, a Shecky Green.
Right, right. And here we are in and he's fawning over another celebrity here, perhaps loosely modeled after Joey Heatherton. And this is on one of his many appearances on the Sammy Maudlin Show.
Let me just say, Lola Heatherton represents everything that's good in this town. As a person, she's marvelous. And as a performer, she's absolutely marvelous. And I love her. I really do.
She's the best.
I really
she's
do.
The best.
Bobby Bittman, you're so sincere, it's scary.
Now, Bobby, look. I read that you were in Washington testifying before a congressional committee on the drug problem here in Hollywood.
That's right, Sammy, and funny you should bring that up because I didn't think you could read.
Oh, hilarious.
Wow. That bit went on to say, you know, I just want to tell everybody out there, Sammy, that I don't get paid with the white stuff. I get paid with the green stuff.
Right. And, of course, radio really doesn't do justice to Bobby Bittman. I mean, we're looking at a guy with a bright red coat,
chains. He's got the chains. He's got the rings. He had a ring on every finger except one. And you know why he did not wear a ring on that one finger?
Why is that?
Overkill.
Would have been just too much. Right,
yeah.
Right. And always the cigarette, right?
Always the cigarette. Yes, I know. Well, that was those were the days.
Was there any a comedian that Bobby Bittman was sort of modeled on?
His personality, I borrowed from Jerry Lewis, you know, as who he is as a person, not necessarily as his act. But when he was speaking seriously, you know, as a comic in all seriousness, mm-hmm. that was kind of a Lewis-ism.
Right.
And that's what I kind of borrowed from for the character of Bittman.
Let's hear one more character that we've got on tape here, and this is the estimable Sid Dithers, what do we call him, a Jewish grandfather private detective?
Private Detective was just one of the shows that he right. had on SCTV. He was an old Jewish man, okay. Not that tall, and you know there's kind of an image, and you don't have to just be in Florida, but you will sometimes see, and I remember as a kid just seeing images sometimes of these little guys with white hair driving these you know, big kind of, you know, Buicks going back to the 50s and 60s, those big cars.
Right.
And all you see is like the little head behind the wheel. That's how short they were. And that was the
and a pair of white shoes down there at the bottom.
That
if
was
you
the
ever
character
get
and a white belt.
All right. Well, let's hear Sid Dithers. And in this scene, he is a private detective and a distraught father comes to him for help.
Mr. Dithers, I came a long way to see you. I could have contacted the police in San Francisco, but I have a feeling my daughter's right here in Beverly Hills.
San Francisco? So how did you came? You drove and did you flew?
Mr. Dithers, the only thing that's important is whether or not you'll take the case.
Yes, and I'll tell you why. Because I'm a man who loves children. Now, you've got a little girl who was kidnapped. I myself have a son who's now a successful lawyer, and has two gorgeous little girls of his own. Cigar?
That was Sid Dithers, played
yes.
by my guest Eugene Levy all those years ago. What does that bring to mind?
So how did you came? You drove and did you flew?
You know, so many of these characters are so over the top. I mean, all these ethnic accents and overdone stuff. And there was a lot of physical elements to it. And you had nose putty and beards and
Absolutely.
Mustaches and a lot of this stuff.
You're kidding? It's my craft.
Well, then you get into movies, and then we just see Eugene Levy. I mean, was it different to kind
well,
of
you see, you see Eugene Levy with maybe a set of buck teeth in Best in Show. You see him with a couple of left feet. You see him... I still like to don a wig or two. I still like to, it's true, you see me, Waiting for Guffman, the most exciting thing about that movie for me was finding those glasses because, you know, brought new meaning to the 80s, you know what I mean? They were big and magnified and, you know, I still like a good prop.
Right, so you look for just that touch.
But
right?
You know, but it's true in movies, you are more yourself and this has to come out. I remember doing the television show years ago. I mean, SCTV, and it was John Candy for the most part who appeared in everything as himself. All the characters he did, we would say, John, you're not putting on a mustache for this. You're not putting on glasses. No. It's fine. And people, you know, identified with his face. I mean, you know, he was the only guy in the company that where you could tell who it was, kind
right,
of, you
that's
know.
Right.
So there was some method behind his madness.
My guest is Eugene Levy. His new film with Samuel L. Jackson is The Man. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is Eugene Levy. He's made more than 60 films. His latest, in which he stars with Samuel L. Jackson, is called The Man. Well, you've been acting for a long time, but in 1999, this role that you had in American Pie got you a lot of attention, particularly maybe with a younger movie-going set.
Oh, yeah.
Why don't we hear a clip of you? Now, you're playing Jason Biggs' father here, right, whose name I believe was Jim, a young man who's exploring, an adolescent man exploring his sexual identity and... we have a scene here where you, as his dad, come in for a little heart-to-heart.
Oh, Jim, you're here. I was just walking by your room, and you know, I was thinking, boy, it's been a long time since we've had a little father-son chat. Oh, I almost forgot. I bought some magazines. Do you want to just flip to the center section? Well, this is the female form, and they have focused on the breasts, which are used primarily to feed young infants, and also in foreplay.
Right.
This is Hustler, and this is a much more exotic magazine. Now they have decided to focus more on the pubic region,
right.
The whole. Groin area.
Uh-huh.
Look at the expression on her face. You see that? See what she's doing? She's kind of looking right into your eyes, saying, "Hey, big boy. Hey, how you doing?"
My guest, Eugene Levy,
wow.
Playing Jim's father in that breakthrough role in American Pie. You know, it's interesting. The role was a little different when you played it than it was as written, right? You looked at this and decided it needed a little tweaking. Right?
Yeah, you know, when I, first of all, getting the script and reading the script, it's not something I kind of jumped to do right away. It really was a raunchy little script, and I thought, boy, you know what? They're really out there. I don't think this is necessarily for me, but I went in to meet with the brilliant young guys who put it together, Paul and Chris Weitz. And I didn't like the role. The role of the dad was written kind of in a slightly crass way. It was a smaller role and nudge nudge wink wink kind of thing with his son. And I said, boy, I want to change the part. And they said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to change everything. So we kind of went in and improvised in a rehearsal all the scenes. We I kind of played the kind of guy I wanted to play, which was a father who was a so well-intentioned, you know, that he could deal with something like walking in and seeing his son humping a pastry and take it on himself like it's his fault, like it's something he didn't do, that he's got, it's up to him to try and steer his son in the right direction.
Did you feel comfortable with the kids seeing American Pie? They would have been, what, adolescents at the
time?
My
kids were, my daughter was about 14 when that movie came out. My son was, I think, 16. My daughter, I said, you can't come to the premiere because first of all, it's illegal. You can't, it's an R-rated movie, so you can't see it. I said, however, you know, I said, if you can find a theater somewhere that somehow allows you and your fake ID to get in and see the movie, I don't have a problem with it. It's not the movie I will never be able to watch it with you.
Right.
You know, that will never happen with this movie, unfortunately. It's not something we can do together. But if you want to go with your girlfriends and see it, I think you're going to find it very funny.
Are there any SCTV roles or movie characters that you're particularly fond of?
You know, I have a soft spot for a lot of characters on SCTV, and some of them are not, you know, kind of the major characters that I do. I do have a soft spot for Bittman, but there are other little tiny roles that I've played here and there, like a game show contestant in a Russian game show.
Can you conjure a little of that for us?
It was a show called Upo Skrabelnik, and it was a show when we lost the feed on SCTV, and we somehow got hooked into CCP1, the Russian television network, and we picked up this Russian programming, and it was just a character with a great kind of Eastern European look, reminiscent of a Shmangi, but he was just in terribly intense, and he had a little buzzer the size of a football, you know, that he would have to hit when they asked him a question, and his eyes were just so intense, and his eyes were riveted on the moderator as he was asking the question, and then he would hit his buzzer with such intensity. Tiny little role, but I never tire of watching that when it comes up in reruns.
If we were to hang around the Levy household, would we hear these characters coming out as you speak to your wife and kids from time to time?
I do have the ability sometimes to get to my kids and get them laughing through characters, and I can go into Stan Shmangi, in the kitchen with my kids and really pour it on to the point where they actually start laughing.
I'm so glad he's still around.
Stan is still here, and it is a terribly sad thing Yosh isn't.
Well, Eugene Levy, thanks so much for stopping by, spending some time with us.
Boy, it was an absolute pleasure. Thanks.
Actor Eugene Levy. He stars with Samuel L. Jackson in the new film The Man. You can also see him in episodes of SCTV, which are now available on DVD. Coming up, Ken Tucker on new country music CDs from Brad Paisley and Brooks and Dunn. This is Fresh Air. One of the standbys of country music is the drinking song, in which the singer seeks comfort amid life's disappointments at the bottom of a bottle. Rock critic Ken Tucker points out that two songs on new albums by Brad Paisley and the duo Brooks and Dunn approach the time-honored subject from distinctly different points of view.
I'm not some come-on-strong Romeo cowboy. No, I'm not that type. Without a little help, I'd probably have two left feet. But you ain't gonna let that happen tonight. Turn up that jukebox, set me at the bar. I promise her the moon, you throw in the star.
Where rock and roll has expended most of its substance abuse energy creating hymns to or cautionary tales of marijuana, LSD, cocaine, and heroin use, country music's drug of choice is definitely alcohol, for a number of reasons. Foremost, it's comparatively cheap and legal, at least post-prohibition. The genre has a sizable number of tunes about homemade moonshine, most notably George Jones's White Lightning. And it's cheap and legal for adults. If rock and roll started out as teen music looking for the thrill of a high, whether romantic or chemical, country has always found its biggest audience among grown-ups seeking liquid respite from bad jobs, bad marriages, and bad inner demons. The twist that the country duo Brooks and Dunn apply in their new song, Whiskey Do My Talkin', is to directly address alcohol as a companion, the enabler that will enable the singer, after a few swallows, to overcome his shyness, speak more eloquently, and snag that attractive woman down the other end of the bar. Personification, they call it in literary terms. For Brooks and Dunn, whiskey is a man's best friend.
Oh, I tell her all the things I can. Here's to you, my hunter-proof friend. Go on, do your thing. Yeah, she's just a light away from falling, going wild and honky-tonky.
Not long ago, the cable music channel CMT, Country Music Television, did a show called The 40 Greatest Drinking Songs. They repeat it occasionally, but I don't recommend any production that makes the all-time number one drinking song Garth Brooks's Friends in Low Places. Oh, that's a perfectly catchy bit of rowdiness, but if we're talking rowdy, you have to listen to Jerry Lee Lewis's What Made Milwaukee Famous Has Made a Loser Out of Me, a mere number 28 on CMT's list, and nowhere near the greatness of Webb Pierce's 1953 masterpiece, There Stands the Glass, shamefully placed at number 11, not even in the CMT's top 10. Or Gary Stewart's magnificently baroque 1975 melodrama, She's Actin' Single, I'm Drinkin' Doubles, which never even made Country Music Television's list at all. But when CMT updates its show, you can bet that young, handsome Brad Paisley's admirably blunt new song called Alcohol will probably figure prominently.
I can make anybody pretty. I can make you believe any lie. I can make you pick a fight with somebody twice your size. Well, I've been known to cause a few breakups. I've been known to cause a few births. Well, I can make you new friends or get you fired from work. And since the day I left Milwaukee, Lynchburg and Bordeaux friends, been making the bars lots of big money, helping white people dance. I got you.
Alcohol is the only country song I know which is sung from the point of view of alcohol itself. The first person singular in the song is booze. I especially like the verse that invokes both Ernest Hemingway and lampshade wearing.
I got blamed at your wedding reception for your best man's embarrassing speech. And also for those naked pictures of you at the beach. I've influenced kings and world leaders. like he did. And I'll bet you a drink or two that I can make you put that lampshade on your head. 'Cause since the day I left...
Brad Paisley's Alcohol, in which the substance feels alternately proud and faintly ashamed of its own powers of influence, is an example of the poetic device known as the pathetic fallacy, attributing human feelings to inanimate objects. It's an extremely clever piece of songwriting that avoids one of the things that non-country music fans find off-putting about the genre, the fact that it's so often such a downer. By settling for clever, Paisley will certainly score a big hit. Love that line about alcohol helping white people dance. But his song won't enter the pantheon of mature despair that can make drink-drenched country music so powerful.
Ken Tucker reviewed Brad Paisley's new album, Time Well Wasted, and Hillbilly Deluxe by Brooks and Dunn.
There stands the glass that will ease all my pain, that will settle my brain. It's my first one to take. Stands the glass.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Mike and Scott. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
I'm wondering where you are tonight. I'm wondering if you are all right. I wonder if you think of me in my misery. There stands the glass. Fill it up to the brim till my troubles grow dim. It's my first one to take.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from Entrepreneur Media, publisher of Entrepreneur's eBay Startup Guide, featuring resources for starting an online business, on newsstands now, and from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
University of Chicago law professor Cass Sunstein has called Justice William Rehnquist one of the most important figures in the entire history of American law. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with Sunstein about the career of Justice Rehnquist, the appointment of John Roberts, and the future of the Supreme Court. Join us for the next Fresh Air.